Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.
It's November the 2nd, and we are beginning Sefer Ezra Nehemiah, the book of Ezra Nehemiah. And it is one Sefer, even though we have it broken down into two, with Ezra being 10 chapters, and Nehemiah being, I think, 13 chapters. It is really one Sefer. And the Gemara actually discusses why Nehemiah did not get a Sefer named for him. The name of the Sefer is Ezra. It's called, colloquially, it's called Ezra Nehemiah, but it's really Sefer Ezra. And the Gemara discusses why Nehemiah did not deserve to have a name, to have a Sefer named for him. So we'll get to that later on when we examine Nehemiah in more depth. Before we begin, we need to remind ourselves, for those who were with us for Sefer Daniel, we need to remind ourselves where we stand historically when Sefer Ezra begins. So if you were with us for Sefer Daniel, much of this will be just a review. And if you weren't, then this will get you up to speed for what we're about to do here in Sefer Ezra. Remember that when the first Beis HaMikdash, the first temple, was destroyed, it was destroyed in stages. The actual destruction happened, of course, at the hands of Nebuchadnezzar, and it happened when the king was Tzidkiyahu. And we know that the Golos, the exile the Jews went to after the destruction of the first temple, the Golos Babel, the Babylonian exile, lasted 70 years. However, when Nebuchadnezzar first conquered Eretz Yisrael, when he conquered Eretz Yisrael for the first time, which was not when he destroyed the Beis HaMikdash, it was 18 years prior to the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. He conquered Yerushalayim, and at that time the king was Yehoiakim. That was the king, Yehoiakim, and Nebuchadnezzar conquered Yerushalayim. When he conquered Yerushalayim, he did not take the Jews into exile, he did not destroy the Beis HaMikdash, he didn't even remove Yehoiakim as king. He left Yehoiakim as the king, even though he had conquered Yerushalayim. And the Jewish state became a tributary state to Babylonia. We had to pay taxes, but we still had our king Yehoiakim, and we still had our Beis HaMikdash. That was 18 years prior to the destruction of the first Beis HaMikdash. Then, as we've mentioned before, Yehoiakim ended up rebelling against Nebuchadnezzar, and Nebuchadnezzar came back and conquered Yehoiakim a second time. And this was 6 years after the first time he conquered Yehoiakim. This time, since Yehoiakim had rebelled, he took Yehoiakim away, or he actually killed Yehoiakim, and put his son Yehoiakim, or Yechanya, sometimes he's called Yehoiakim, sometimes he's called Yechanya, same person, as king. And so he replaced Yehoiakim, who had rebelled, with Yehoiakim, and left, and went back to Babel. Now, it was a long trip back to Babel with all of his army. When he got back there, his advisors told him, how do you get rid of the one who rebelled and then put his son in charge? You're asking for trouble all over again. So Nebuchadnezzar accepted the advice of his advisors, turned around, went back to Yerushalayim, conquered Yerushalayim for a third time, and this time took Yechanya, Yehoiakim, the king, and Hacheresh v'Hamasker, the Jewish leadership, to Babel. And we've mentioned this many times because that is how Yechezkel ended up in Babel, that is how Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah all ended up in Babel. That is how Mordechai ended up in Babel. All of them were taken into captivity, into Babel, into exile, when Yehoiakim and Yechanya was taken into exile. And this was still 11 years prior to the destruction of the first Beis HaMikdash. I mean, Nebuchadnezzar did not destroy the Beis HaMikdash, did not destroy the temple. And he replaced Jehoiachin now with his uncle, Tzidkiyahu. His uncle, Tzidkiyahu, the brother of Jehoiakim, of Jehoiachin's father, now becomes the king. And Tzidkiyahu remains king for 11 years. And at the end of that 11-year period, Nebuchadnezzar returns. Again, there is rebellion. Nebuchadnezzar returns. This time he destroys, he conquers Yerushalayim now for the fourth time. He destroys the Beit HaMikdash and takes all the people into exile. And that's the progression in stages of the destruction of the first Beit HaMikdash. There's even another stage, which those of you who heard the talk that we had on Shom Gedaliah, the stage even after that is with the murder of Gedaliah, because when Nebuchadnezzar took all the Jews into exile with the destruction of the first Beit HaMikdash, there was a remnant that he left there, very small remnant that he left there, and he appointed Gedaliah to be the leader of that remnant. Eventually he was murdered out of jealousy, and then the last remnant of the Jews in Eretz Yisrael left. They were left and they ended up being killed out. Yirmiyahu the Navi was the only one who remained of the leadership of the Jewish people after Yechaniah was taken into Galus. As I mentioned, Yechezkel went and Daniel went and Mordechai went. Yirmiyahu remained behind, but with the destruction of the last remnant under Gedaliah, then even Yirmiyahu left. So that was the different stages of the destruction of the first Beit HaMikdash. Why did it happen in stages? We have to assume that part of the reason, if not the only reason, why it happened in stages is that Hashem was giving the Jews, all of us, a chance to see the writing on the wall and to understand that we had better do teshuvah in order to prevent the ultimate destruction that was to occur. So it happened in stages. So let's review exactly how that happened. Again, Nebuchadnezzar conquers Yerushalayim for the first time 18 years prior to the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, that is under King Jehoiakim. That's the first stage of destruction. Then 6 years later, with a rebellion of Jehoiakim, Nebuchadnezzar conquers Yerushalayim a second time and gets rid of Jehoiakim and replaces him with his son Jehoiachin or Yechania. The very next year, which we'll call year 7, counting from that first time that he conquered, he comes back and conquers Yerushalayim for a third time and takes Yechania and all of the Jewish leadership to Bavel. 11 years later, which we'll call year 18, he comes back and he had put Tzidkiyahu in charge, Tzidkiyahu the uncle of Jehoiachin. He comes back on year 18 and conquers Yerushalayim for a fourth time, and he takes all the people into Golus. And that's the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. And as I mentioned, there's even another stage with the murder of Gedaliah. There are two prophecies, which we mentioned when we did Sefer Daniel. There are two prophecies about the Golus of Bavel lasting 70 years. One is mentioned in Sefer Yirmiyahu, and one is mentioned in Sefer Daniel. The one in Sefer Yirmiyahu says that the Golus, the exile, will last until 70 years for Bavel. 70 years for Bavel. And then, in Sefer Daniel, it says 70 years from Charvos Yerushalayim, from the destruction of Yerushalayim. Those two psukim are ambiguous enough that they could have meant the same thing. But the way that it turned out, for whatever reason, is that just as the destruction happened in stages, so too the rebuilding happened in stages. Because 18 years prior to the rebuilding of the Beis HaMikdash, the rebuilding of the second Beis HaMikdash, 18 years prior to that, is when Koresh, who was the Persian king, the Persians and Medes had replaced the Babylonians as the major power in the world, the Koresh gave permission to rebuild the second, rebuild the Beis HaMikdash, to build the second Beis HaMikdash. He gave permission. Jews came back to Israel. Not all the Jews, but many Jews returned to Israel. They laid the foundation of the second Beis HaMikdash, and then the work was stopped. And it was 18 years later that permission was again granted, and the work was completed. So the two prophecies that there's a 70-year exile, both came true. There was a 70-year exile counting from the first time Nebuchadnezzar conquered Jerusalem, which was 18 years before the destruction of the first temple. 70 years from that first conquering of Jerusalem, which we would call 7 years of Babel's supremacy. 70 years later, that is when the permission was granted for rebuilding the Beis HaMikdash, and the foundation was laid. But then it was stopped, and it took another 18 years, and then finally permission was granted a second time, and it was actually rebuilt. And that was 70 years from what? From the destruction of the first Beis HaMikdash. We need all of this background, because all of this is going to be alluded to and dealt with in the first few prakim, the first few chapters of Ezra. Sefer Ezra Nehemiah, this book that we're about to start, is about the building of the second Beis HaMikdash. But not only about the building of the second Beis HaMikdash, it's about the reestablishment of the Jewish presence in Israel. And it is about how the leadership, Ezra and Nehemiah, brought the Jews back from Babel. Of course, many Jews remained in Babel, and Babel was, until only very recently, the longest community of Jews that had the longest consecutive stay in one place, where the really until the establishment of the State of Israel and the Arab countries throughout all the Jews, the Jewish presence in Babel, which is Iraq, was ongoing since the time of the destruction of the first Beis HaMikdash. Many Jews remained in Babel despite the fact that the second Beis HaMikdash was built. But the book of Ezra Nehemiah is about this reestablishment of the Jewish presence in Israel with the Beis HaMikdash. Of course, the second Beis HaMikdash paled in comparison to the first, in that there were many things that were missing. There were miracles that were missing, so it paled in comparison. And the Jewish presence in Israel paled in comparison to the first. We did not have a king. We were still under the rule of the foreign powers, whether it be the Persians or the Greeks or the Romans. But we were under foreign rule, except for a brief time under the Hashmonaim with the Hanukkah story. But nevertheless, there is a second Beis HaMikdash. It also paled in comparison in the amount of Israel that was occupied by the Jews, where in the first temple era, in its heyday, which is under Shlomo, the state of Israel expanded very far north and very far east. Much all of today's Lebanon was under the state of Israel. Much or all of today's Syria was under Israel, and it just expanded very, very far. With the second Beis HaMikdash, the second time that we were back in Israel, the Jewish presence was primarily in and around Jerusalem. What is called today the West Bank is primarily where the second Beis HaMikdash settlement was. Where if you leave where the West Bank is today, you're entering areas that were occupied by Jews during the first Beis HaMikdash, but not during the second Beis HaMikdash. In other words, the West Bank is Israel, the rest of it is the occupied territories. What I mean to say is, our claim to the West Bank is much stronger than it is to the rest of Israel. Because the West Bank is where the Jews were most recently. That's where we were during the second Beis HaMikdash. We were not in Tel Aviv during the second Beis HaMikdash. Or if we were, it was a very small presence. I mean, there was no city there anyway. But that area was not where we primarily were. Primarily in and around Yerushalayim. That was where the Jewish presence was in the second Beis HaMikdash. It was much smaller, much more contracted than it was during the first Beis HaMikdash.
Oh, what's that Bethlehem?
Well, that would have been under... Jews would have been living there, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What's that?
That's not far from Yerushalayim.
Right.
That's not far. Let's just give a little bit more background with the with the kings who were in power throughout it's not just 7 years, it's really 88 years, because we're starting 18 years before the destruction, going all the way to the construction of the second temple. So we've got a span of 88 years. So of course, Nebuchadnezzar and Babel were in power at the outset of this very terrible time of destruction. And Nebuchadnezzar was succeeded, as you know, from Sefer Daniel, he was succeeded by his son Evel Merudach, who was succeeded by Belshazzar. And then the Persians and Medes won a decisive battle against the Babylonians that was foretold by Daniel with the famous story of the handwriting on the wall. And then the Babylonians cease to be a power and the Persians and Medes take over. The first king to take over is Dariush the First. He is a Mede, and he is the one under him. That first year is when you have the story of Daniel in the lion's den, as we learned recently. And he only lasts a year. He's killed in battle, and his son-in-law, Koresh, who's Cyrus, also the first, he takes over, and he's a Persian. He's not a Mede, he's a Persian. And he rules for the next 2.5 years or so. He's the one who authorizes the building of the second Beit HaMikdash, and the foundation is laid. And then, as we'll see that it was stopped and why it was stopped. Then, after Koresh, who's a Persian, the next king is the famous king Ahasuerus. Certainly there was no building of the second Beit HaMikdash during Ahasuerus's reign. He was very anti-Jewish. And in his time comes the whole story of Purim with Haman and Mordechai and Esther. And when the story of Purim ends with Esther married to Ahasuerus, they have a son. That son eventually succeeds Ahasuerus as king. And that son, who is named either Dariush or Koresh, he's got both those names. Mm-hmm. He's the second Dariush or the second Koresh. He's the one who authorizes the second Beis HaMikdash, and it is rebuilt under his rule. So that's where we are. Now, when Sefer Ezra begins, it begins with the rule of Koresh the First, Cyrus the First, the Persian, who authorized the rebuilding of the Beit HaMikdash the first time, 18 years before the actual rebuilding of the Beit HaMikdash. That's where Sefer Ezra begins. So let us begin. The first chapter is 11 psukim long. It's 11 verses. We're going to read all of them. We're going to read all of them. And then we'll go back and go through it a little more slowly. Okay. We'll give Mrs. Kaiser a chance to shut off the heat. If anybody has a question, ask it now while we have a chance to shut off the heat.
When you said there were no Jews at one point, were there still, you know, a few Jews there, or absolutely no Jews?
It seems that once Gedaliah was murdered and the Jews ran away to Egypt, then there was nothing left. It seems like it was desolate. That's what it seems. Uvishnas achas the Koresh melech Paras. And in the first year of Koresh, the king of Paras, king of Persia. So whenever a book starts Uvishnas, and in the year, Uvishnas achas, and in the first year, how do you start a book with the word and?
Something else must be going on.
Something else must have happened beforehand, right? So Rashi tells us this is meant to come right on the heels of Sefer Daniel. That's why we're learning it at this point, since we learned Daniel recently. This book follows Daniel in very short order. Right after Daniel ends, Ubishnas Achas, and in the first year. That's how we begin. My wife always likes to tell the story of it. One of her teachers in seminary, who she liked very much, who would start off every single one of her classes, Amarnu, we said, and begin that way. So she was in Israel during the first Gulf War, the year of the first Gulf War. And since there was a deadline for when the war was going to start, because the United States had announced when it was going to liberate Kuwait, Saddam Hussein, Yimach Shmo, he is threatened to bomb Israel. So everybody knew when that was going to happen. So many of the girls left prior to that date, including my wife. She was my in-laws brought her home at that time. So the war ended on Purim, and my wife went back to Israel. Actually, she went back on Chol HaMoed Pesach, and right after Pesach, she started classes again. So the seminary had not been given regular classes for the past couple of months. So she remembers that first day back, and she walked into class, and the teacher came in, and just closed the door, and said, "Amarnu, we said." Uvishnas achas the Koresh Melech Paras, and in the first year of Koresh, the king of Persia, lichlos devar Hashem ipir miyahu. It was at the end of the word of Hashem from the mouth of Yirmiyahu. That's a reference of Yirmiyahu, actually. That's the reference to the prophecy that Yirmiyahu had said that the destruction will last, or that the exile will last for 70 years. Now remember, this is 70 years not from the destruction, but 70 years from the first time Israel was conquered by Nebuchadnezzar. So this is the end of that prophecy. That prophecy has come to an end, meaning it's the end of that 70 years. Heir Hashem Esruach Koresh Melech Paras. Hashem awakened the spirit of Koresh, the king of Persia, Vayaver Kol B'chol Malchuso, and he passed a declaration throughout all of his kingdom, V'gam B'michtav, and also in writing, Lamar. This was announced, and it was in writing as follows. This is what Koresh announced. You see that the way that Ezra presents it is not that the king Koresh all of a sudden became benevolent to the Jewish people and became a righteous person and authorized the building of the second Beis HaMikdash. Rather, Hashem awakened his spirit that he should do so. This echoes what Shlomo HaMelech writes in Mishlei, Lev Melachim Biyad Hashem, the heart of kings is in the hands of Hashem. And kings, when they make national decrees and proclamations, they are not acting necessarily of their own accord. They are doing what Hashem tells them to do in order for Hashem to have the various forces that he wants going on in the world acting the way they should. Pasuk Beis, verse 2. Now this is the proclamation that was said by Koresh. Kol amar Koresh melech paras. So it says Koresh, the king of Persia. Kol mamlechos haaretz natan li Hashem elokei ha-shamayim. All the kingdoms of the land were given to me by Hashem, the God of the heavens. Koresh was very enamored with Daniel, and as a result, he acknowledged Hashem's supremacy. And he says that all the kingdoms of the earth were given to me by Hashem. Here, Koresh is claiming that he has control over the entire known world. It was not true. This was his own ego getting in the way. But the Gemara says, Gimel Malchu Bekipa, only three kings ruled over the entire known world. Only three, with a fourth as a possibility, but only three are mentioned as those who ruled over the entire known world, and they are Nebuchadnezzar, ruled over the entire known world.
Shlomo.
What's that?
Shlomo.
Okay, Shlomo is the fourth. We'll mention it in a minute.
Alexander?
No. Alexander didn't make it all the way.
Oh.
Achashverosh ruled over the entire known world, and Achav. Achav, who was an evil Jewish king, ruled over the entire known world. Ruled does not mean that that on a political map you're going to draw the boundaries over the entire known world. That's not what it means. What it means is the king had control over all the other kings. They all had to sit up and listen. If he said jump, they said how high. That's what it means. So Nebuchadnezzar, Achav, and Achashverosh are the three that had that sort of power, and Shlomo HaMelech did as well. The Gemara doesn't count him for one of two reasons. Either the Gemara says that he's not in the same list because he did not, his kingdom didn't last. He didn't end up with control over the whole world. He did at one point have control over the whole world, but he lost it. That's one explanation as to why he's not listed. The other explanation is because his control was greater than the other three, because he not only controlled the physical world, but he controlled the spiritual world as well. That whatever that means, which we don't understand, but the shadim, the demons, whatever they are, which we don't understand, don't ask me to explain it because I can't even pretend to understand it, but there is some other things that are going on that we know. There are things that go on that we can't see, we can't touch, we can't perceive, but they're out there. And Shlomo HaMelech had control even over them. So he's not counted amongst the other three who only had control over the physical world. Be that as it may, Koresh did not have control over the entire world, but he did have control over a lot of the world. So the Gemara asks the question, but here it says that he did have control over the entire known world. As he says, all of the world Hashem has given me. So the Gemara says, Koresh here, it was his ego getting in the way. He didn't really have control over this unknown world. He just was announcing it as if he did. And he continues, V'upakar alai, and he appointed me, Livnos lo bayis b'Yerushalayim, to build for him a home in Yerushalayim, a house in Yerushalayim, asher b'Yehuda, that is in the portion of Yehuda, in Yehuda's portion. This is notable that Koresh is referring to Yerushalayim as being in the portion of Yehuda when there are no Jews living there. There's no Jews there. And yet, he refers to it as Yerushalayim that is in Yehuda. So you see that he is immediately acknowledging that the land of Israel is going to go back to its rightful owners, and that is going to be primarily under the tribe of Yehuda. Gimel verse 3. Mivachem mikol amo, who amongst you from all of his nation? Yehi elokav imo, let his God be with him. V'yal liyushalayim asher b'Yehuda, go up to Yerushalayim that is in Yehuda. So he's officially giving permission for all Jews who would like to immigrate to Yerushalayim that is in Yehuda, they should do so. V'yiven espes Hashem Elokei Yisrael, they should build the house of Hashem, the God of Yisrael. Hu ho Elokim Hashem Yerushalayim, he is the God, the power that is in Yerushalayim. V'chol ha'nishar mikol ha'mekamos asher hugar sham, and all that remain from all the places that they live there, meaning that if anybody, any Jews, don't have the money, don't have the resources to make the trip, they can't do it. Traveling, relocating is expensive, and if they can't do it, what should happen? So this is Koresh announcing an astonishing thing. Yinas'uhu anshe mekomo, the people of his place should lift him up, which means they should help him financially. This means the non-Jews living in those areas where there are impoverished Jews who can't make the trip, the non-Jews should help out. The chesef uvezahav, with silver and with gold, uverchush uvebehema, and with possessions and with animals, im hanedava, along with a gift, that was for the house of Hashem in Yerushalayim. In other words, the non-Jews living in the areas where there were Jews who couldn't make the trip, the non-Jews should give money and assistance to those Jews that they can make the trip, and along with that, a gift, a tax-deductible contribution to the building of the second Beis HaMikdash. Pasuk Hey, verse 5. Vayakumu Rashi Ha'avos LiYehuda uBenyamin, and the heads of the families of Yehuda and Binyamin got up. It's only Yehuda and Binyamin because the 10 tribes had been taken into exile many years earlier and they were not in contact with the two tribes, Yehuda and Binyamin. V'akohanim v'alevim, and the Kohanim and the Levim who are also with Yehuda and Binyamin. L'chol hi'ir ho Elokim esrucho, for all those who Hashem had awakened their spirit. L'alos livnos espes Hashem asher b'Yerushalayim, that to go up and to build the house of Hashem in Yerushalayim. The calls of Yivoseim, Chizku v'Yedem, and all those around them, the non-Jews, they strengthen them in their hands, so they are listening to the decree of Koresh. Bechlai Kesef, Bazav, Barchush, Uvavehema, Uvamigdanos, with silver utensils and gold and possessions and animals and Migdanos. Migdanos are good foods. What did you say?
Provisions,
right? Levad al kol hisnadev, in addition to what was donated to the cause. Pasuk 9, verse 7. Vehamelech Koresh, this is also astonishing. Vehamelech Koresh hotzi es klei veis Hashem. And the king Koresh took out all the utensils of the house of Hashem. Asher hotzi v'nu Nebuchadnezzar Yerushalayim, that Nebuchadnezzar had taken out of Yerushalayim by name of Esel Elohav, and he, Nebuchadnezzar, had placed them in the house of his gods, of his deities. He had taken the utensils and put them in his pagan places. So Koresh took them out. Vayotziem, Koresh, Melech Paras, Koresh, the king of Paras, took them out. al yad misridus hagizbar, at the hands of misridus, that's a person's name, hagizbar, the treasurer, vayispireim, and he counted them out, l'shesh batzar hanasi liyehuda, to shesh batzar, the prince of Yehuda, the leader of Yehuda. There was a, his name was Shesh Batzar, although we know him by another name. But the Nasi, the prince of Yehuda, whose name was Shesh Batzar, he is Daniel. That's correct. He is Daniel. He is the leader of Yehuda. Remember that Daniel descends from the line of royalty, and he is the leader of Yehuda, and Koresh takes out the utensils and has them counted out, not just given over, but actually counted out. There was an accounting of what they had taken, and it was being given back to Daniel, to Shesh Batzar, and we'll talk about why his name was Shesh Batzar in a moment. We also need to discuss these utensils, because there's so much history involved in these utensils, and where they had been and where they had gone, and we'll have to talk about that as well. So we'll come back to this as soon as we finish the parak, finish the chapter. We'll come back to these few verses to discuss the utensils and also discuss Shesh Batzar. Pasuk Tes, verse 9. Yes?
Why is it important that they tell us who the treasure is and give us that name?
That's a good question. I don't have an answer for you. I've wondered that myself. I don't have a good answer. There are several names of... When it's the Jewish names, so even if we don't know them by any other name, we don't know who they are, but there we can argue that they're mentioned for posterity, that they're, you know, they had this position, they did this and this good thing, so their name is mentioned. But in this case, what difference does it make what the name of the treasurer of the Persians is? I don't know. Yes?
Okay, but as you're saying, you usually mention somebody's name when you give them merit,
mm-hmm,
or credit.
Or the opposite.
Right.
Either way.
Right. So, assuming it's merit, so this fellow had guarded them safely.
Okay, that could be. It could be that it's being mentioned as a merit for him, for posterity, that he faithfully guarded the utensils of the Beis HaMikdash. That is certainly a possibility, but I don't know for certain. I have not seen a discussion about it. That doesn't mean there isn't a discussion about it. I just haven't seen one. Pasuk Tes, verse 9. The Elam is Param, and these are their numbers. Now we're going to get a detailed accounting of the utensils. And I have to mention to you right here that in Sefer Ezra and Nehemiah, there are going to be parts, unlike Sefer Daniel, and certainly unlike Sefer Yonah, there are going to be parts that we're either going to read through very quickly, or we may even skip, because there's a lot of names and a lot of detail that is written down, which, although one who knows a lot more than I do may be able to expound upon each and every name, but we're a little bit limited in that way. So we're going to run through some of it very quickly. This is not so long, what we're about to do, but there are parts of Sefer Ezra that do read very quickly because it's a very detailed lists. And so here's the first one. So these are the numbers of those utensils. Agartelei Zahav. Agartelei is a fancy word for utensils. Golden utensils, how many? Shloshim. 30 golden utensils. Agat alechases, how many silver utensils? Aleph, 1,000. Macharofim, knives, Tisha ve'esrim, 29. 29 knives that were used in the Beis HaMikdash. Kiforei zahav, golden, a kippar is a utensil, a bowl or a cup to catch the blood. When an animal was slaughtered, they had to catch the blood. That is called a kippur. So the golden, we'll call them bowls, shloshim 30. Kippurei chesef mishnim, the silver bowls. Mishnim means as seconds, meaning the gold were the main ones, the silver were the secondary ones. Arba meos v'asara, 410. I'm sorry, I stopped in the wrong place. No, that was right. Sorry, yeah, thank you. Kelim Acherim and other utensils, Aleph 1,000. So they are counted out over here. Now, if we added up what was just counted, you have 30, you have 1,000, you have 29, that's 1,059. You have another 30, which is 1,089. And then you have another 410, so you're up to 1,499. And another 1,000, which is $2,499. But then, the next pasuk, Yud Aleph, called Kalim Lazav Vela Kesef, all the utensils for gold and silver, Chameshes Alafim Barbameos, $5,400. So that's a lot more. It doesn't figure. So as Rashi explains, in the name of Chazal, the first list were the main utensils. The main utensils came out for $24.99. But there were other utensils that were not as important, and if you added it all together, another roughly 3,000 utensils, you ended up with 5,400 utensils. Hakol he'ala sheish batzar im he'alos ha'golah mibavel Yerushalayim. All of them were brought up by sheish batzar with the going up of the those who had been in exile from Bavel to Yerushalayim. So there was in this first wave of returnees from Bavel to Yerushalayim, they came with them 5,400 utensils from the Beit HaMikdash. Now, the utensils of the Beit HaMikdash were very significant, and again, those who were with us for Daniel already know the significance of these utensils. And even those who weren't, but those who are familiar with the Purim story, also are aware of the significance of these utensils. And that is that the utensils of the Beis HaMikdash were the last remnant of the Beis HaMikdash. The Beis HaMikdash had been burned down, and there was nothing left. At least, perhaps there was the Kosel Maharavi might have still been there, I don't know. But there was nothing tangible that you could deal with that was part of the Beis HaMikdash, except the utensils. The utensils were still there, and they were beautiful. It would have been a travesty to melt them down. They kept them as utensils. The non-Jewish kings who had conquered the Beis HaMikdash, Nebuchadnezzar and his successors, kept these utensils, and what they wanted to do was to use them for Avodah Zarah, for idolatry, and use it for their own use. To show that they are now in charge and not Hashem. The thing is, though, that they were rather nervous about these utensils. And that is because, as I've mentioned to you before, that although they did destroy the Beis HaMikdash, but they had a healthy fear of Hashem and a healthy fear of the Jewish people. And these prophecies that had been floating around, which the non-Jews were aware of as well, something about 70 years was frightening to them. Because as long as there's a prophecy that 70 years after the destruction is going to be a rebuilding, then there's always this nagging feeling that Hashem might come back and he might reclaim what is his. And so they were scared. Nebuchadnezzar, for all of his evil and for his destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, he was not willing to use the utensils for himself. He put them away in the houses of worship of his idolatry, his paganism, and left them there. But he didn't use them himself. His son Evel Merudach, likewise, didn't touch them. It was not until Evel Merudach's successor, Belshazzar, he had counted 70 years. He made a mistake in his count, but he had counted 70 years. He had thought they had come to an end, and then he took out the utensils and used the utensils publicly in a massive party to show that the Jews and Hashem are finished, and we, the Babylonians, have control over the world, and there's nothing to fear. That night, because he used the utensils, that's where the hand appeared and wrote on the wall that foretold his destruction. And Daniel, who was there, interpreted what it said. Well, he was called to come there. He wasn't there at the time. He was brought there, and he read it, and he said that it foretells the destruction of Babel. And he, Belshazzar, was murdered that night, and the army of Babylonia was destroyed by the Persians and Medes, and the Persians and Medes took over. So when this happened, that only reinforced the fear of these utensils, because Nebuchadnezzar was afraid to use it in the first place because what might happen. And now when someone did use them, it actually happened. His whole, not only was he killed, his whole kingdom was wiped out. And the power passed from Nebuchadnezzar, from Babel, from Babylonia, to the Persians and Medes. So using these utensils was not a simple thing. And so, again, they were put away. Here, Koresh takes out those utensils and gives them back to the Jews. That is to show that now the Jews are getting back in control. Now, I'll get to your questions in a moment. But we all know that what happens next is the work for the Beis HaMikdash is started and then stopped. And then Koresh is succeeded by Achashverosh. And Achashverosh waits until the third year of his reign. And he also counted 70 years. He also counted wrong. He counted wrong for a different reason, but he counted wrong. And he makes the big party that Megillas Esther starts with. The whole story of Esther starts with this party. And in that party, we read in the Megillah that he used v'chelim mikelim shonim. He used utensils from old utensils. He used strange utensils, unusual utensils. And when the Balkria reads it on Purim, although the tune for Megillas Esther is a festive, enjoyable tune, but when he gets to those three words, v'chelim mikelim shonim, he changes the tune to the Eicha tune, which is a very sad tune. And that's to hint to the fact that Achashverosh was using the utensils of the Beis HaMikdash, because he didn't learn his lesson and decided that although Belshazzar had counted wrong, I know how to count better. And he feels that he had counted right and he took out the utensils. He again was wrong, and the Gemara says that that is why Vashti, who was a descendant of Nebuchadnezzar, was killed at that party. That's why Hashem had Vashti killed at that party, was because of these utensils being used. Not only that, but Vashti's being killed at the party puts Esther in place of Vashti, and it is through Esther that the story of Purim unfolds, the Jews are saved, and it is her son that authorizes the rebuilding of the Beis HaMikdash. So it is the use of these utensils in the wrong way which undermines the entire intent of the use of those utensils. The whole point of using the utensils was to proclaim publicly that God is finished, the Jews are finished. And instead, the use of those utensils puts Esther in place right under Achashverosh's nose. And he doesn't even realize that he himself is setting the stage for the rebuilding of the second Beis HaMikdash. So those utensils, which were given here to Daniel, to Sheish Batzar, and were taken back to Israel, must have eventually been brought back to Persia. Because then, Achashverosh is going to use them again for his party a few years later. Okay, so did I cover the questions? Yeah.
I thought, maybe it was just Midrash, that Achashverosh, in addition, had all the goblets were from the Beis HaMikdash that he served wine into the Jews, and that he also wore the Begadim of the Kohan Gadol.
That's correct.
So, but you said that there wasn't really anything left from the second Beis HaMikdash. Besides these utensils, and these utensils don't mention goblets or
there's 3,000 utensils that weren't... that weren't specified.
So that could have been that.
Yeah.
And the big day kahuna.
Yeah, so here it doesn't mention about the clothing. It's only mentioned about the utensils. That would have been included. That's right. Yeah.
I have two questions when I read this first paragraph. Well, it's mentioned a couple of times. So I have two questions. And it's the sentence that says, "He is the God who is in Jerusalem."
Mm-hmm.
And it's said several times. It's mentioned several times.
Yes.
So it's trying to drive home a point. So do you have a commentary on that?
Well, it's Koresh talking. It's the Persian king talking.
Right.
And he is characterizing Hashem as being in Yerushalayim. In other words, that Hashem, that's his place. And that's where he...
But it seems like by mentioning it several times, not only trying to tell people about it and remind them, but to elevate. That's
well, either that or to limit. Yeah. He may be trying to say Hashem is only in Yerushalayim.
Only in, yeah, that's a good point too.
Right.
And then the other thing about the, you know, the utensils and so forth that were brought back to the temple or going to be brought back to the temple. Now, they have been profane, so they're kosher? What happened to them?
Okay, that's a very good question. Actually, the discussion about this, I saw mention, I didn't read through the entire thing, but I saw mention, I saw Rav Moshe Feinstein discusses this point, and he proves from here that although they were taken and they were used incorrectly, but that does not ruin them to the point where they can't be reused. They were certainly tamei, and they had to be put in the mikvah, but that did not render them invalid. They could still be used for service in the Beis HaMikdash.
I thought that they would be used, but I just wondered at that time, since they had been profane, which is what we make mistakes sometimes.
Right. When we keep them kosher. Right. Well, that's not making it profane. We just sometimes make them not kosher, which is a different. This would have been worse.
So they would have taken to the mikvah.
It seems that, and it seems it was right. They would take it to the mikvah, and it seems that it was able to be reused. That's what it seems. Yeah. Yeah.
I was wondering, you know, about this transfer of goods. You know, what it looked like. In other words, did they have like 10 wagons with all? You know, did they go in wagons all these beautiful utensils? Did they get wrapped up, and who drove them?
I don't know. That's a good question.
Do you know?
I don't know. This whole discussion is going to be repeated later on, and maybe we'll see more detail over there. But I don't think so. If I remember correctly, we're not going to get that much more detail.
Because we traveled from Babel.
Yeah, and it was quite a trip.
That's quite a trip.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And I was wondering about robbers.
Yeah. Well, they were under the royal protection.
Of what?
I mean, Koresh was, you know, he was, no one was going to bother the Jews at that point. When we get to Israel, it's going to be a different story. But
so he had a royal kind of...
I don't know if he actually sent soldiers with them, but they would have, people would have gotten in big trouble if they would have started up. Koresh had sent proclamations around, you know, and he had sweeping power. He could kill somebody at the drop of a hat.
One last question, just for now. How many miles are we talking about? Where we were in Bethel and Iran?
I don't have that at the tip of my fingers, but we're talking about, if you can picture the Middle East, we're talking about traveling from between the rivers, between the Euphrates and Tigris rivers, around the area of the Persian Gulf, traveling northwest, traveling between the rivers, and then after getting to where Syria is today, changing to southwest and getting down into Israel. So you're traveling facing you, you're traveling from here up like this and then down like that into Israel. You couldn't travel across because it was all desert. It still is all desert. Today, because we have other means of travel, you can go across. But in their day, that was a death sentence. You had to follow the fertile crescent up and around.
We're going to have to bring the map because it would be so nice to see.
Yeah, I have a map. You're right. I should have brought it.
Well,
yeah.
Thank you. What did Koresh do to deserve him being the one to proclaim that?
That's a good question. I don't have a good answer for you. From Sefer Daniel, we see that he was taken with Daniel himself. So was Dayavish, his father-in-law. And they were taken with him. And it could be that they had some sort of acknowledgement of Hashem, and that's why they deserved it. But I don't know for sure.
What were all those utensils?
What's that?
The three, almost 4,000 things.
Yeah.
That were taken. What was among them?
They would have been various types of goblets, and you needed different types of, you remember there was fire, and had stuff to stoke the fire, and all kinds of little things. And we're familiar with the big utensils. With the, you had the shulchan, which is the table, and the menorah, and the mizbeach, and all kinds of, but there were a lot of little things. Running the Beis HaMikdash required a lot of different things. I'm actually surprised there was only 29 knives. And that, you know, knives would have been a major commodity in the Beis HaMikdash.
Big and sharp.
It could be these were only the main knives. It could be there were other knives.
That doesn't surprise me. The reason it doesn't surprise me is because knives were used very sparingly in certain types of situations, and they were held very
specialized
and special.
Okay, yeah, that could
like
be.
People used to have salt,
right?
You know, and kept
right.
it in a coffer.
There was a special room in the.
Not everybody had a knife.
Yeah, there was a special room in the Beis HaMikdash called Beis HaKhalifos, which is the room of knives.
Yeah.
So what you're saying sounds like that's they actually kept them in a special place. It wasn't just, you know, where all the other utensils were kept.
Right, because they wouldn't want those to become
But
the Kohen didn't have any forks and knives when they ate all the carbonos.
Well, I don't know if anybody ate with forks and knives.
No, they ate with their hands.
They needed knives to slaughter the animals and to cut it up. But I don't know if they ate with a fork and knife. I mean, that's a relatively new
convention. And then even later on, much later on in history, some people just ate with a knife. There was no fork.
Right. If you go to my house, you can find people eating without forks and knives.
And I heard that when forks were invented in England, the priests were all against their being created.
Really?
They said that if God had meant to give you forks, he wouldn't have created fingers.
Oh, really? Okay.
There you go.
Yes, last question. We're going to get to Kishesh Batar. Go ahead.
What happened to the main things in the first Beit HaMikdash? Were they buried and hidden? What's the story about
Some, the Aron was never taken. The Aron was hidden away. They never got the Aron, the Ark. That was hidden away, and it was not returned for the second Beit HaMikdash. So the Ark never reappeared.
What about the menorah and the Shulchan?
The menorah and the Shulchan, they would have gotten. And that what's that?
That's the second
Beit HaMikdash. The first Beit HaMikdash, they may have gotten them. I don't know where they went. But they can be, you don't have to use the same ones. They could have made another one.
Right, we just don't see them mentioned
here. Right, they're not mentioned here. You would have thought, since they're so specialized, that they would have mentioned. It's a good point. I'm not sure. Now, why is Daniel called Sheish Batzar? So, Sheish Batzar is a contraction of two words, Sheish, which means six, and Batzar, from the word Tsar. Tsaras. Narrow or it means troubles, right. Because he endured six troubles. He lived through six Tsaras. That's what the Gemara says. The Medrash says he lived through six tsaros. Now, which six tsaros did he live through? There are two counts that I saw. Both counts agree on four of the six, but they disagree on what the other two are. The four that both counts agree on, let me sure I get this right. The four that everybody agrees upon are the that he was thrown into the lion's den.
Mm-hmm.
That's one. That he saw the conquering of Jehoiakim. That's the first time Nebuchadnezzar came and conquered Yerushalayim. He saw the conquering of Jehoiachin. That's when the leadership was taken into exile, including Daniel himself. And he didn't see, but he lived through the conquering of Tzidkiyahu, which is destruction of the first Beit HaMikdash. So
destruction of the what?
Of the first Beit HaMikdash, of the first temple. So the stages that we spoke about before, since he lived through all those stages, three of those stages are counted towards these six major calamities that he lived through. The first time Yerushalayim was conquered, the time that the leadership was taken into exile, and finally when all the people were taken into exile. Those three were counted towards the six, plus his being thrown in the lion's den, which was not a fun thing to go through, although, of course, it had a happy ending, but that was a scary and difficult thing to have gone through. That's four. What are the other two? So, again, I saw two different ways of counting it. One way of counting it is that, number one, if you remember way back in the beginning of the book of Daniel, we saw that Nebuchadnezzar had a dream and he woke up and he couldn't remember what he dreamt. Mm-hmm. And he called all of his sorcerers and all the different the stargazers, whatever it was, of Babylonia, and he told them, I want you to tell me what I dreamt and what it means. And if you can't tell me, then I'm going to put you all to death. So they all said, what are you talking about? Nobody can do this. There is not a human being on the face of the earth who could figure that out. How could they tell you what you dreamt? Well, nobody knows. If you tell us what you dreamt, we'll tell you what it means. But you can't tell us to figure out what you dreamt. So he says, no, if you can't figure it out, I'm killing all of you. And they couldn't figure it out, and he started to kill them all. until Daniel came and told Nebuchadnezzar what he dreamt and what it meant. But before that happened, the decree to kill all of the advisors and sorcerers, etc., of Nebuchadnezzar included Daniel and Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. They were all included in that decree. And as the executioner was going around killing people, they were included in that death sentence. So that was also a sorrow that he went through until Baruch Hashem he was saved. And the other one would be the witnessing Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, his good friends, being thrown into the fiery furnace. He wasn't actually there when it happened, but he lived through that terrible decree of being thrown into the furnace. So those two things, the death sentence on their heads and the them being thrown into the furnace, those are the additional two plus the four we mentioned before, according to this opinion. There's another way of counting it, a different medrash, that agrees on the first four, but the last two, it counts. I remember one of the two. I'm trying to remember what the other one is. One second. It counts, I believe, the stopping of the work that we're going to have over here, that they started to build and then they were stopped. I think that's the one. I'm not sure about that one. And Haman. That Daniel lived through the period of Haman. Haman was a very difficult time for the Jewish people. The fear that they were all going to lose their lives. So he lived through that as well. So he is called Sheish Batzar because he lived through six sorrows.
And these are not tests. These are sorrows.
Right, right. Now, why would he be called that? He wasn't the only one who lived through tzaras. Other people lived through tzaras as well, number one. And number two, even if it's true that he has a name, Sheish Batzar, why would that name be used here? He has other names. He has a name, Daniel. He has a name, Hasach, as he's mentioned in the Megillah and Megillah's Esther. We've talked about this before.
Didn't realize he was mentioned in the
in Megillah, yeah. According to many opinions, that Hasach is Daniel. He has a name given to him by Nebuchadnezzar called Belshazzar. So why call him Sheish Batzar, which is a name which is going to be used again in Ezra? We'll find it several times. But why make reference to this name specifically? We're out of time already. But why use this name specifically in this place?
I think it's because of the miracles that occurred. In these six troubles, miracles occurred.
Right, right. So what you're suggesting is that it's not the troubles that are being emphasized, but the fact that he lived through them and saw through them. See, not all of them had miracles. The destruction of the Beis HaMikdash didn't have miracles occur. That was all bad.
Yeah.
But he is now seeing the rebuilding of it all. So he is, these sorrows that he lived through, all of them, he lived through them and saw their resolution.
What about that time when the first thing that happens, I think it's the first thing that happens to him, he's praying and king's whatever spies see him.
That's when he gets that's when he gets thrown in the lion's den.
Yeah. That's when he's going to be thrown into the lion's den. But that was the, okay, so
that's one of the things. That's what I'm going to say. So there's a resolution. He sees the resolution to all of them. So a possible reason why Sheish Batzar is used over here is because here is the resolution to the destruction that he had seen. He had witnessed the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash in all of its stages, and now he's about to see the first stage of the construction of the Beis HaMikdash. So he's seeing the resolution of it as it moves along. Yeah.
It's also a prophecy in giving him that name, because it means he won't have a seventh challenge.
Okay, that's interesting.
So there's prophecy within the prophecy. Okay. There's an end to all our sorrows.
I like
there's
that.
There's a number to it, and
I like that.
There's no additional sorrows.
I like that. The problem is that really, since there's a machlokas, how to count it, we end up with eight, right?
So he gave him that name, though.
Well, I mean,
did he give it to himself, or?
It sounds like it's Ezra using the name. That's what it sounds like. Either that, or Hashem caused the name, just like with the bris, where we say that the parents are given some sort of minor prophecy to be able to name a child properly. Somebody gave him a name that was ended up being, you know, appropriate.
The number six that would apply in any kind of spiritual life?
Well, six, usually when it's just straight, this number six is used to mean the mundane, like the 6 days of the week, as opposed to the seventh.
Mm-hmm.
That's usually what it's...
Six books of
the Mishnah. Right, that's to deal with each of the mundane, right. Okay, well, we will stop here for tonight.
Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the Donate link. Thank you very much.